let's start on cosmetic surgery. We'll get in as much as we're able to get in. Someone tell me what time it is, because the time restarts when I restart the recording. Okay, so we've got 20 minutes in. That's something. All right, so this class deals with things in a very different way. First of all, we're talking about elective cosmetic surgery. That's something important to note. We're not talking about reconstruction for burn victims. That's not our discussion here. And what I want to show you here is a very different type of a situation. Because whereas in the abortion topic, we have a lot of text to work from and that is legally oriented, when you deal with cosmetic surgery, the texts of Jewish law leave things wide open, which means that Jewish philosophy has a much more potent role to play in our conversation. If you take a look at source number 9, there is a link to a recording of a longer class I've given on this topic where we dealt with much more than we're going to see today. But when you were dealing with abortion, the fundamental questions were, at the end, simple. The answers were complicated, but the questions were simple. What is the legal status of a fetus, and what might justify aborting it? Right? Those were your questions. What are the key questions involved in elective cosmetic surgery? So one question, Marilyn points out the question of vanity, meaning, I'm going to put it in a little bit of a gentler term, is beautification a respected value in Judaism? How do we view beautification? What is the place of physical beauty in Judaism? How flexible is Jewish law regarding issues of self-esteem, which come into the discussion of beautification? Self-esteem is a nicer way to say vanity, I think. No, it's not. I didn't mean that in a negative way. It came out negative. I didn't mean it that way. But there's another question which was mentioned here. Wounding. The issue of, under what circumstances, if ever, am I allowed to physically alter my body? Right? Who is the owner of a person's body? Right? Today, my body, my choice, right, is a classic mantra, not just today, but for decades that's been the mantra. But where does that come out within Judaism? Am I allowed to wound myself? Am I allowed to take risks? All surgery, right? This is a basic axiomatic principle. All surgery involves risk. Whether you're talking about anesthesia, whether you're talking about infection, whether you're talking about spending time in a hospital and the different germs that are floating around, you know that there is risk. Can the risk involved in harming the body ever be balanced out by the reward? In this case, in terms of beautification, self-esteem, whatever, are human beings meant to improve upon divine creation? Do we say, well, God made it, and therefore, you know, leave it as it is? Tell that to the mole. That's what Diane was saying. I know you. I didn't hear a word you said, but I knew exactly what you were saying. Okay. So that's what we need to address here. That's what we need to know. These two basic questions, under what circumstances am I allowed to physically alter my body, and is beautification a respected value in Judaism? That's really what it comes down to. So first we deal with the first question, which is,
Can you define elective surgery? Because there's emergency surgery, and then there's my surgeries were quote-unquote elective.
So the question, right, so you're asking an important question, but I think that it's a scale to which we need to apply the principles we come up with. In other words, we're going to be talking about whether beautification ever justifies this. And basically what we're going to say is, for anything where Jewish law accepts this is an important thing to do, we really no longer view it as elective. It takes it out of the category of elective and makes it more towards this is a required thing.
So it's not the medical definition. That's right.
Correct.
It's a Jewish definition.
Correct. That's what you get in Jewish law. Yes. This is true. What Susan is pointing to shouldn't be trivialized. This is actually a very important point, which is we move the goalposts effectively based on how we view beautification. It's not that we're going to end up saying this is elective, but it's okay. Once we say that it's warranted, it really stops being elective. But then we say, okay, this is something that you should do. So the definition of elective will shift based on our conclusion. So we go back, as always, to biblical text. Take a look, please, at source number 10, one of many verses that I could have brought for this point. We are told that we are not allowed to endanger ourselves. This particular verse, "Vinishmartem ma'od l'nafshoteichem," you shall guard your lives greatly. Again, there are many verses you could bring to support that idea. You're not allowed to harm yourself. You're not allowed to risk your health. Harm to oneself includes, potentially, even doing things that diminish your experience of life. I gave you an extreme example in source number 11. There is something in the Torah called the law of the Nazir. A Nazir, Nazirite in English, which I think just explains everything, is somebody who has taken a vow which prohibits him or her from the following activities: cutting their hair, drinking wine or in general having grape products, or coming in contact with the dead. They can't go to a funeral, they can't take care of a dead body, they can't come under the same roof as a dead body. So why one would take such a vow is a good discussion for another time. But the point is not that. My point is this. Take a look at source number 11, which describes how a Nazir ends the period of being a Nazir. They say for 30 days they're going to be a Nazir. What do they do? What's the ritual at the end of 30 days? So it includes bringing karbanot, bringing offerings. Look at the offerings that the Nazir brings. Source number 11. And the Nazir shall bring his offering before God. An unblemished lamb in its first year as a burnt offering, an unblemished ewe in its first year as a chatat, an unblemished ram as a shlamim. The chatat is the one that I want to focus on. What is a chatat? I deliberately did not translate it. What is a chatat? So people automatically associate chatat with the word chait. It is a sin offering. Usually, a chatat is brought as part of an atonement process when a person recognizes that they have broken certain biblical laws. It is indeed part of an atonement process. Now, the truth of the matter is that the Torah includes various cases of korban chatat, so-called sin offerings, that are not atonement for sin. The Talmud says so. But because the rituals that are done with this offering are the same as the rituals that are done for a sin offering, they're all lumped together based on the rituals. This korban, this offering, is brought with the rules that we associate with a chatat. So, for example, a woman who gives birth brings a korban after birth, and it is called chatat, even though the Talmud says explicitly she's done nothing wrong, this is not about a sin. Nonetheless, the rules for this korban are the same as the rules for a chatat, in the sense that the kohen eats this part, the owner of it has that, you know, all the different rules for it are the same. And the most common version of it is the chatat for a sin, but in and of itself is not associated with sin. Just before I take questions on it. My point in bringing this is the Nazir has to bring a chatat. So one way to look at it is the way I just said, which is the Nazir didn't do anything wrong, took a vow, honored the vow, is done with the vow, and now this is the korban they bring. It happens to be like a korban chatat. But there's another school of thought Talmudically which says, no. He did sin. The sin of the Nazir is in swearing off wine. Because God has prohibited enough things for you. God has prohibited enough things for you. It's not for you to start adding prohibitions. If God said to you, this is permitted, it's not for you to take vows and say, I'm not gonna have any. It may be it's not good for your health, in which case it is prohibited. An alcoholic is not allowed to drink wine. But in the case where it is a healthy thing and a person just says, I'm taking a vow, so there's an element of transgression involved because he caused himself that pain, and that's why he brings the korban. So that view argues that no, you're not allowed to do things that harm yourself. You're not even allowed to do things that diminish your pleasure in life. That's one view. Diane, you were going to say?
I'll ask it later.
Okay. On the other hand, we have plenty of sources in Jewish law that indicate you are allowed to risk harm in order to gain a particular benefit. Take a look at source number 12. Discusses the case in which one person has harmed somebody else. And it asks, so what kind of payment do you have to make to your victim? And among the payments are, he shall give payment for his rest, meaning time lost from work, and he shall heal him. You have to pay medical bills. This is one of the basic sources in the Torah for the fact that there is a position of doctor, that medical treatment is recognized. We're going to talk about this more next week when we talk about healthcare costs and the issue of paying the doctor. But the point here, and the reason why I bring this here, is that the Torah is saying you should engage in medical treatment. But all medical treatment involves a risk. There's always a risk with medication. They always give you a box full of side effects. It's not only because of the lawyers. There really are side effects. And it could be it only affects 1 in 1 million people. But if 100 million people take this medication, that means 100 people are going to get hurt.
Yeah.
You deal with large numbers, right? Look at all the studies that come out and the rates of harm. You recognize there's always risk that's going to be involved, and yet it is accepted. Another example of it, source number 13. This is the law in the Torah that states that if you have an employee, you are responsible to pay the employee on time. And on time, in the biblical sense of it, means if he's being paid by the day for his work, then you pay him same day. None of this term plus 30, as far as the Torah is concerned. Source number 13. Pay him that day. The sun shall not set before you pay him. For he is a pauper, and he puts his life on the line for this. Ve'elav hu noseh et nafsho is the biblical text. Lest he call out to God regarding you, and it will be your sin if you don't pay him. The Torah takes it very seriously. But my point in bringing this is not to underscore the importance of paying somebody for their work. My point is the line that it gave here about why he puts his life on the line. The Talmud comments on this, and it states, in expanding on this, this person may have taken a job working in a tree. Right? He climbs the tree. He may have taken a construction job. He climbs the wall to do work. Right? He climbs whatever scaffold you have. He puts his life on the line. But that raises a question. I thought you told me in source number 10, you shall guard your lives greatly. You're not allowed to hurt yourself. You're not allowed to risk your life. So on what basis is it that somebody is allowed to endanger himself to pursue a salary? Right? There are certain careers that are very dangerous careers, that are known to be more dangerous. Clergy is an example of that. You laugh. There are careers that are indeed dangerous. What's the justification for going onto a construction site? Right? Where there really is such a level of risk. What's the justification for it? And the answer, as Marilyn says, is because the family is starving. That's exactly right. But that introduces for us the idea that risk may be justified for a particular gain. Go back to the Nazir, right? The Nazir also has a particular gain. The Talmud understands that a person might take a vow of becoming a Nazir if they see that they're out of control. They say, you know what? I need to rein myself in. I'm going to avoid certain activities, grooming in terms of the hair, the wine, and even the contact with the dead. By abstaining from that, it limits your social contact. You have to be very careful about making yourself impure. You come in contact with somebody, you don't know where they've been. That can communicate impurity to you. The inability to attend a funeral. The idea is that this person says, you know what, there is a benefit I need, and it's going to justify swearing off wine for 30 days. So sometimes you are justified in entering into risk for a particular benefit. Let's apply that now to the cosmetic surgery case, the elective cosmetic surgery case. On the one hand, we say there are risks, and you hear the horror stories on the news. Right? From people either who did it without, you know, proper certification, proper supervision, the Botox problems that happen from time to time. Or even in cases in which people went in for a regular surgery, routine operation in a hospital setting with board certified physicians and everything else, and yet they get hurt. So the question is, will we say certain benefits justify risking harm? Ruchama.
When we're talking about the cosmetic surgery, and we see that actually in the Bible, beauty and
yeah, we're going to get there.
If you think about Rachel and Leah, That's because she was a hoopa, and yet because he didn't even fight her.
We'll get there.
And
right. You'll see. If you want to turn the page to 19, you can look at 19. You are right, but we're not there yet. But look at number 19. But in terms of benefits that justify the risk of harm, yeah. Take a look, please, at source number 14. We're not there yet, but you're right. But take a look at number 14. Rabbi J. David Bleich, in his book Contemporary Halachic Problems, has an essay on cosmetic surgery. And he notes the following. I think this is from that essay. He says, although every therapy is fraught with danger, the hazards of treatment are specifically sanctioned when incurred in conjunction with a therapeutic protocol. Accordingly, the practice of the healing arts may be permitted, even if designed simply for the alleviation of pain. He's talking here about medical care in general, and he says, we justify undergoing surgery for the sake of alleviating pain. So what about the person who feels emotional pain and seeks to remedy it through cosmetic surgery? Now, you can make the argument that it's not always justified. It's not always indicated. Right? There should be some kind of look at the psychology of the case before you rush into surgery as a solution to the problem. Understood and accepted. Nonetheless, what he's opening the door for with his statement here in number 14 is indeed that there may be justification for a potential benefit. It doesn't justify entering every level of risk. It doesn't justify risking every level of harm. Some surgeries are more dangerous than others. The potential downsides for some things are greater than for others. It doesn't justify entering risk for every percentage chance of benefit, right? What if there's a small chance this will help you? Then what? It doesn't justify every minimal benefit. It may help you, but it's going to help you in a tiny way. So each case is going to require evaluation. You have to look at precedent. You have to look at the different factors that are involved. But what we've seen in this first part is that you can make the argument, you may make the argument in Jewish law, that harming oneself for a benefit is permitted, and therefore one will be allowed to enter into surgery, assuming the benefit justifies it. That leaves us with the second part of this. Look at your watch. That leaves us with the second part of this, which is beautification a respected value in Judaism? Which has the question of, is it appropriate to pursue beauty? Ruchama points out that biblically we have texts that praise beauty. True. But also, the question of, is there anything wrong with correcting God's work, so to speak? So that's the one I want to handle first. Take a look at source number 15, please. We're going to do this very quickly. Source number 15, biblical verse, the commissioning of humanity. God blessed them, and God said to them in Genesis chapter 1, bear fruit, multiply, fill the land and conquer it, and reign over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, and all the beasts that roam the earth. God says, this is in your care, and you are expected to conquer the world. You can make the argument that had Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, taken this mandate at the beginning, they wouldn't have eaten from the fruit, because they would have filled the earth. They would have been outside the garden. God said, leave the garden. You stayed inside. What happens when the kids stay inside? Right? You know, they get into trouble. Maybe when they go out also. But the idea is, you're supposed to fill the earth. Take a look at source number 16. The Maharal of Prague makes the following statement. Just as nature operates at divine decree, and nature functioned during the 6 days of creation as is appropriate for nature, the same applies to the actions of a person with his brain which is above nature and with his deeds which are not of nature. In other words, what he's trying to say, and I brought you maybe too small an excerpt, but what he's saying is, God gave us the abilities that we have. If we have the ability to alter the natural world, it's part of what God gave us, and it's within our mandate. Not against the commandments and prohibitions that were given. So, for example, I have a biblical prohibition against grafting species in certain ways, interbreeding species in certain ways. He'll still recognize that's a prohibition. But if the Torah doesn't say no, then it's part of the abilities I've been given to use. And to put a more positive spin, that's sort of the negative, saying there's no prohibition. But the last source I want to show you is a source that even says that this sort of creativity is an imperative. Take a look at source number 17, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, in his work Halachic Man. He says, the scriptural portion of the creation narrative is a legal portion. When you read the story of creation, take it as a legal imperative, in which are to be found basic everlasting halachic principles. I mean, the way he reads the opening of Bereshit, the opening of Genesis, is not just a story of how the world came to be. It's an instruction. If the Torah then chose to relate to man the tale of creation, we may clearly derive one law from this manner of procedure, that man is obligated to engage in creation and the renewal of the cosmos. Meaning, the Torah talks about human beings emulating God. It depicts God as being creative. The imperative is for us to be creative as well. Not only, as Maharal said in the previous source, is it not prohibited, but it's actually positive. We are supposed to improve on. God left us room to improve on the world. That's guarding the garden, correct. And so the argument of, well, you can't justify intervening and improving the body, it's God's work, doesn't hold water. We are given the ability, other than in cases where it is prohibited, and therefore that's not a concern. But the last bit, which we will have to see next week at the start, is whether beautification is an appropriate pursuit. And what about where there is risk? How do we view the pursuit of beauty? So we started at the point. We'll finish, God willing, in the beginning next week and move on to healthcare costs as well. Again, if anyone is not on the email list for the class, please see me. And I'll add you. Thank you very much.